Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you're here today.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
Welcome to NARC, Narcissistic Abuse Recovery Collaborators. This is home to NARC Troopers. It's a website where you will find a library of work to help on the recovery journey from narcissistic abuse. Today, I'm excited to have a very special guest with us. And, you know, we have people come from time to time and each bring their different stories and expertise. Today, we have Amy Punt. She's a multifaceted writer, weaving personal essays and nonfiction narratives that resonate with the human experience. As an accomplished opera librettist, I knew I was going to get that wrong. Amy brings a unique perspective to storytelling, blending emotional depth of personal trauma with the artistry of operatic expression. With a background in screenwriting, playwriting, and poetry, she utilizes a multidisciplinary approach to her writing to offer a glimpse into the healing process using the transformative power of storytelling. Amy has produced opera libretti that have won NASA grants, as well as development grants through Opera America. Her work delves into the themes of isolation, loss, and betrayal, providing a raw and insightful exploration of healing from trauma and abuse. So, Amy, welcome today.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, I want to begin our conversation addressing that narcissism manifests in many different ways. And there are many different systems in our world that are plagued with this in what seems to be an increasing number of ways that it's showing up. And this would be for all cluster B disorders, the narcissist, the psychopath, the sociopath. And people just seem to surrender to these disordered types, whether they be politicians, world leaders, you know, it could be family members, your spouse, your child, maybe parents. It could be your boss at work. There's a lot of ways that it can show up. But I would like to focus today, I think, on the way that we have spiritual narcissists among us who prey upon the vulnerable and the susceptible populations in sort of a, you know, using the church as a tool to get to these people. And I know that you have personal experience to share with us today. So I'll let you tell us a little bit about that. And then we'll talk about how to recover from something like that, because even though there's many different types of ways that narcissism and psychopathy and such can manifest in the world today, the way that we recover from it seems to be, you know, there's a common denominator there. It seems like the path forward with that is very similar, regardless of what type of narcissism that it was. So those are the two things we're going to be looking at today. So tell us a little bit about your experience with the church and the spiritual narcissist.
Sure. I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home. And, you know, the experience, I have two brothers, one older, one younger. So the family roles were, you know, my parents were very traditional, but the power dynamic was sort of anything but. So my father, you know, he went out and he made the money, and there was that sort of giving, the idea that my father was the head of the household was very much prevalent in our home, but it was really my mother who had all the power. And he basically abandoned his duties as a father to her, raising us, being completely, you know, having complete dominion over our lives. And so he would really only come in as the enforcer. But that early paradigm of the narcissistic, the power structure, my mother being the narcissist and my father being kind of the enforcer or the flying monkey or the one who kind of helped keep her mask in place. And the mask was that we were this traditional Christian family, but it really just covered up a whole host of abuse that was occurring in my home. And I'm not an outlier. I think a friend of mine said something on social media recently, and she posted an article about a Christian leader who had just been arrested in Philadelphia for, I think, having relationships with children, abusing children. And she said, why does this always happen in the church? And I said, well, I can tell you if you really want to know. And so I feel like narcissism is maybe not a bug, but a feature of these very religious environments, because it allows abusers to proliferate, to abuse with impunity, right? And exactly. So what happened in my life was, you know, there was a double standard for the men and the boys, and me being the only girl. I grew up to be the perfect Christian girl, even I was also the scapegoat. Because in Christianity, there's this, look, if you obey, then you are going to get God's blessings. And so I thought, well, if I just am perfect enough, I will finally get the love that I need. And that was constantly the carrot that was being dangled in front of me. Mm-hmm. Whereas my brothers were just like doing all sorts of sinful behaviors, like the church would consider sinful. I don't know that I necessarily would now, but I mean, you know, just doing whatever it was they felt like doing, and with no consequences. In fact, I would be punished if I told on them. So, you know, that carried over into the church, and I got into a relationship with a big church, a mega church, that was very narcissistically abusive, where I was constant. They said I was working as a volunteer in a church that had the money to pay me. They were a very wealthy in place. And they kept saying all these reasons why they wouldn't do it. It's just what ended up happening was one person on my team so undermined me, because he wanted my position, but he wanted it to be paid. And they believed everything he told them. And they hired him. They told me they would only hire me if I had a master's degree. At the time, I had an undergraduate degree. And they hired him over me. And he hadn't even finished his associates and didn't even plan to. It seems to me that looking back on it now, I feel like the only benefit they got out of that was really like free labor, you know, because I worked so hard. But there also seemed to be like some sadistic pleasure in it for them, is what I feel like now. And maybe that's revisionist history. But it was a very painful awakening for me. But it's when I begin to understand, oh, no, this is not a bug. It's a feature of this religion. And I know there are a number of people that I am still friends with now who are also no longer Christians because of the treatment that they experienced in that system, at that particular church.
Well, narcissistic abuse follows steps. It's a cyclical progression from the beginning stages, the love bombing, the infatuation, idealization, all of this kind of thing. Which I would think in this context, the people coming into this particular congregation would be feeling that they had finally found their church home, and that they were welcomed, and that they were very hopeful and excited, and they were given attention and special treatment and made to feel very comfortable and all of that. And then the then there would be the conditioning part, the entrainment, the mind mastery, the control. Control is a huge factor with all narcissists, even the spiritual narcissist cult type leaders do that. And then they criticize and condemn and control in these ways through this devaluation stage, so that the person is, that intermittent reinforcement is a pattern that happens to cause addiction. And what that can look like in the church, tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that they hold the carrot like this is what you are as a Christian supposed to achieve, and when you do, you're going to have everlasting love and paradise and the kingdom and so on and so forth. But then there's the punitive part, the you don't measure up, you're not doing this right, you're sinful, you're weak, you're failing, you're flawed. There's that part. So that, and then there are the abuses that happen, some of them patriarchal in nature, because I think churches in general are sort of built on a very patriarchal system, for the most part. I won't speak of, like in generalities to say it's that way with all of them, but with a great number of them, I know that that is true. And so there are abuses and boundaries that are crossed, and people are violated in different ways, depending on what is the method of violation in that church. But all in all those cycles are the same, whether it's a spouse or a parent or a boss, or no matter who it is, all of those components are there. All of, you know, with the conditioning and the control and the punishing and the rewarding and the idealizing and the condemning and just all of it is one big mess. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Just as you were talking, one of the things that I was thinking about was just how love becomes its own coercive tactic. That this idea, you know, when you're in a love bombing, when you're in the phase of love bombing, I mean, it is this experience of elation, this experience that you're being carried on this cloud of perfect love, that feels so unconditional that it does. And I think we've talked about it in another conversation, that it literally feels like it's creating this physical need that you won't be able to live without it, because it feels like the very thing that you were created for. This is the love I've always been wanting. Yeah. This is the thing that I can't breathe without. Mm-hmm. And so that it's right. It's not real love, right? That's a coercive tactic. It's a manipulation. So it's just another way to control you. And in the church, that looks like Jesus's love. So, there's no talk or understanding of boundaries, right? The idea is that once you accept Jesus Christ into your heart, and I can only speak from a Christian perspective.
Right.
So once you accept Jesus Christ into your heart, once they've got you, right? Like that's what they're trying to do, is get you to do a thing. And that is the thing, because now you will have everlasting life.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when the devaluation starts. That's when these, and it's a very confusing time, because you've done everything right. You don't know what's wrong, but now everything you're doing is wrong. And that's how they control you. For me specifically, I remember I graduated college and I really wanted to work in Chicago theater. I had started doing that. And I was working in Boys Town, which is, you know, it's the LGBTQ community. Like you don't do that. That's not a thing you do. And so the church like lobbied really hard with my mom to get me to stop doing that and to come and give my gifts to the church, to edify the church body. That if I wanted a Christian husband, if I wanted the Christian, you know, the gifts of the Spirit and the gifts of, you know, whatever, like that God had intended that right. I have, then I had to do what they said. And I gave up a career in Chicago theater, which was my dream, to go and build a drama team. I used to say that in quotes. I mean, basically, it's so you write sketches every week so that you can support the main message, you know. as an outreach tool. It's not theater, you know. So I mean, it's not real art.
It sounds like all of those pieces are there. I think that, you know, what you said about how at first it feels like it's the thing that completes you, that you can't live without, that it's just, this is the answer to everything you've been looking for. And that's a joyful experience. But then the other things happen that are boundary violations, that are abusive, and all of that. And that is the recipe for addiction. We become addicted to the highs, and it compensates for the lows, so that we tolerate the lows because we love those highs. Yes. And I have noticed the imagery that is created in the church. These pictures of this perfect love, this perfect acceptance, and all of this kind of stuff that is pretty irresistible, actually.
Yes.
And truly. Then a level of energy that it feels so close, like a family kind of oneness with the whole fellowship, like you're all like breathing, moving, singing, praising all together.
It's this
body. Yep. They talk about the body of the church.
Body of Christ, yep.
As it's one thing, unified, which is great, except that can easily be controlled and manipulated.
Well, and there's no internal boundary system. Nobody is an individual. You are only there to be in service to the growth of the church itself, which the church being the bride of Christ. You know, the church being the bride of Christ. So that's our only purpose, that we fulfill God's goals on this planet.
At some point, do they exploit people with their monies and their gifts of time, and take them away from careers, and like make everything about, give everything to the church?
That's
because
right.
To me, all that I have heard about like cults and things like that, that you have to give up your identity.
That's right.
You have to give up your career, your family, even your friends, your relationships. You give up everything and you let it go for some noble higher purpose, which is to become one with this church body.
Yes. And the promise is that it will be replaced by that which God blesses. So I wanted a Christian husband. I had to break up with my non-Christian boyfriend in order to have the guy that God had planned for me.
So there's
no individuality. It's all what the church will give you, you know, as a result of your obedience. So you give everything and the church will then give you what you want.
So in the shared fantasy of narcissistic abuse, when you're in a relationship with a narcissist, you know, there's a kind of entitlement that I'm guessing, you know, we can use the term the church in this context. Some of these churches that we're talking about, not all of them, of course, but some of them, and compare that to a relationship with a partner or with a parent, in saying that they feel that they have everything you need. So you should just be grateful to be there and to give them everything.
Yes.
And that you should just be so honored that you have the opportunity to experience this perfection and this whatever. And that's true, not just your experience with the spiritual narcissist leaders and that kind of thing, who are exploitative and opportunistic and all of that. But that's true for a spouse, a boyfriend, girlfriend, a parent. It works the same way. You know, the parent will say, I gave my life for you, and this is how you pay me back. I've given you everything. I've sacrificed everything. You owe me now. And
it's
so terrible how, you know, parents will do that. Spouses will do some version of that. Like, I've given up. I could be out there. Everybody wants me. You know, I have men, women, whoever, throwing themselves at me, but I choose you. and I've given up all of this, all of these opportunities with these other people.
Some you of should them feel so lucky.
Some yes. of them look better yes. than you, you know, whatever. Yes. And you are so lucky and so yes. fortunate to have me. Give yes. me everything.
But you know, I mean, and you do because they make you feel when they give you what you want, when they give yeah. you that high, there's nothing else like it in the world. I was primed for a narcissistic marriage because of my narcissistic relationships in the church. Absolutely. And because of my narcissistic, you know, growing up year, that imprinted on me, right? That was the template that I absolutely. Understood love.
When you have a parent or a primary caregiver who is a narcissist or creates the abuse, the absence, the neglect, the parentification, the instrumentalization, the objectification, all those things that parents can, where they can go off the tracks and do things wrong to mess you up. If that happens there, then it's like it becomes your script, like you're in a play.
Like, yes. That's a yes.
great analogy for you yes. since you're involved in all that. And yeah. it becomes a script that you stick to because, I mean, that's what you've been given. That's what you've been yeah. programmed like a computer to be your reality. And yeah. so when you get older, you gravitate to other people who are also narcissistic or sociopathic or psychopathic because that feels very natural and normal to you. It's a dynamic that you're familiar with. And it just feels like home. And so you trust it and you go with it and you open yourself up to it in ways that, you know, this is not safe.
Right. But it's, I think it's also too, because you don't know yourself. You don't have your own individual, you haven't individuated from the initial traumas that have created exactly. this. Right. So you lose yourself. And so you're looking for the narcissist to give you something in yourself that you're missing, right? And that's why it forms this really toxic but perfect puzzle piece between you and them. That's they're looking for you, and it feels like they've found you when you feel found.
Well, what happens between the ages of 3 and 6 is that separation from the parent in normal childhood development, and then they individuate and they become their own unique person with their own little identity going forward. And with the narcissist, that doesn't happen as it's supposed to. Something goes off the rails during that time to prevent them from becoming that individual. So in essence, you know, people say all the time that narcissists have big egos and everything. In fact, they don't have an ego at all because they are just pretty much an absence. You have to have some sense of self or identity to be able to have an ego, and they don't have that. They wear yours. They reflect That's yours, right. Mirror and mimic yours because they don't have anything in there.
Right. We're talking about cluster B personality disorders. We're not talking about like garden variety narcissists.
And you know, there is some distinction between the two. If not, they would all have one name, right? I think that the narcissist doesn't intentionally gaslight and deceive and exploit and all of that because they are delusional, detached from reality. They are into this whole magical thinking thing so that they're not living in the real world. So when they tell you something, it's not gaslighting you. They believe it to be gaslighting. It's sort of a calculated plot to exploit or manipulate in an opportunistic kind of way. That's what psychopaths do. Maybe sociopaths, I'm not sure about that, but really a psychopath is just, a sociopath on steroids. It's the same beast. And they know what they're doing because they are task oriented. They have a goal. They want money. They want connections. They want power. They want sex. They want someone to take care of them. They want something. And so they very cold and calculatingly know that they are lying, whereas the narcissist doesn't. So in the church, if you have a leader who comes into, you know, to lead that church, you know, what happens next it's a dangerous thing to have one person be able to have a whole flock and be shepherds to that whole congregation, to that whole flock of followers, that they're going to follow that person wherever they lead. And if that person is disordered, and they say, I'll just add this to the conversation, they say that there are a whole lot of narcissists that are in like the religious church kind of systems. A lot of narcissists are, they go into politics, service things like teachers, doctors, things like that, where they're getting a lot of supply from their patients, from their students, from stuff like that. It's scary to think about these systems, education system, medical system, church system, because these systems can have these people in them who are, siphoning off fuel and supply from the people that are trusting them. And they are just incredibly capable of destroying those people, just decimating them, just completely taking everything tangible, their monies, their house, their relationships, their whatever, to their identity personally, their agency, their power to have control over their own lives and all of that. It's huge. Right? It's a huge thing. And I think that people get so tired of hearing, oh, everybody's a narcissist and everybody has trauma and yada, yada, yada. Let's stop talking about it. I think we need to talk about it more, but in a deeper, more profound way, so that we're not just minimizing it and talking about it like it's something silly or stupid. It is a real pathology. It is a malignant cancer that it has invaded all these different levels of our society, of our culture, of our world. And these people are leading. They're leading and they are winning. And I'm not going to name names, but there are some that are very popular who have control. They have brainwashed. They have cultivized. I don't think that's a word, but, they have done a cult-like mind warp thing to all these people, to have these people blind allegiance following them, when it's just like, what's happening here? What, they're going to lead us right over a cliff. Do you don't see that cliff? Are you looking for the cliff? What's going on?
I wonder if they care, though. I think it comes down to the fact that they are, I read in what, so it's a Japanese novel, be careful what you believe, because it makes you easy to fool. And I think they are believing so strongly in whatever it is this leader is saying, that that's enough. They will live in that deluded reality. That is where they want to live. And they will fall off the ledge believing that they're not falling off the ledge. Does that make sense? They'll go to their death believing that they aren't dying. I've seen it.
What do you mean by deluded reality?
When you believe that the world is black and white, when you believe that there is good versus evil and you are in a battle to win, then that means that you are the good, to win over evil, that makes you very easy to fool. And so because you don't see black and white, you don't see nuances of gray, you don't think for yourself, it makes you easy to fall prey to someone who's going to tell you what to believe.
Right. Well, I think that's absolutely true. And unfortunately, when people only have a very superficial grasp of what this is that we're dealing with here, they're too quick to discount it and minimize it and poo-poo it away, like, oh, well, that's silly, that, I don't even know what you're saying, is kind of the response you get. They don't want to think about it. It's just too much for the average bear to wrap their mind around. They don't have the bandwidth to really dig in until it affects them personally in a devastating kind of way. Then that curiosity, that analysis paralysis sets in, and they can't stop researching it and learning about it and trying to find out just what the heck was that that just happened to me? You know, I was thinking about some of those people who invaded the Capitol on January 6th, and how some of them that are in prison now, not all of them, but some of them have kind of stepped back and looked at they've been self-reflective enough to try to question just what happened there, you know, mm-hmm. and how did they end up in this situation? Because I don't believe that people are just intrinsically horrible, evil, bad people that get bamboozled into these kinds of situations. They're pawns. They're being used on that bigger chessboard in a game where those more powerful narcissistic people are exploiting them.
Right. And that may be, but I don't know that we can, and my feeling is, I think that people are innately and inherently selfish.
Yeah, I'll agree with that too.
And
yes.
Whether or not that makes them bad or not is not maybe relevant to the conversation, but that selfishness, that childishness, I mean, that's
definitely, definitely childish selfishness. And everybody wants like a quick fix, and it just seems like they don't have a lot of compassion for others.
Right.
It seems like
right.
the main thing these days is just to be concerned about yourself. What is best for me? What's going to create the best version of me for me? I need to live my best life. I need to do things that are going to help me. And that's the conversation. It's all about each individual person leading that best life. And if you're in the way, you're inconvenient, just dispose of you and get one that's not, because then that new, less inconvenient person is going to serve you better. And it's all about what serves me to become my best version of myself that I can be. There's no conversation out there about how do I serve others. You just don't hear that.
No, people, and that's the key, the individual narcissism that fits like a puzzle piece with the larger system of narcissistic leadership and
I think that's exactly
psychopathy.
Right. And why do you think that is, that we live in a world where it's where they have so little concern for the suffering of others? It's almost as if their lack of empathy is dangerously close to what the narcissist has, because they have zero empathy. It's all about right. them, their grandiosity, the entitlement, the fantasy that they live in is their fantasy for them with themselves, you know.
Well, and that's why they are worshipped, because like you know, these figures that have that for themselves, these smaller individuals ultimately want that for themselves, right? Like I'm thinking sort of more broadly, we think about the Civil War and we think about the people who went to fight for the wealthy landowners were not people who were also wealthy landowners. They were people who wanted to protect a system that could one day make them wealthy landowners, even if it could never make them wealthy landowners. You know, they wanted to protect a system of slavery where one group of people was less than. You know, and that made that world, that paradigm made sense to them. And being a human being and seeing, you know, seeing them as seeing slaves as human beings was not a part of the conversation.
Mm-mm. No, that's so true. It's like people have always been motivated by what's going to benefit them without considering the damage to others. And you can transfer that to anything happening in the world today. The collateral damage that happens in efforts to achieve victory, right?
Right. I mean,
you know, there's innocent victims. Oh, well, that's just going to happen. It's the cost of justice. It's the cost of having things, you know, of winning.
When you get into a winning mindset, when it's a good versus evil, when it's a black versus white, when it's a my this is mine and I want yours because what yours is also mine. When you get into that, there is always collateral damage. And to me, it feels like historically speaking, we've always been this way, that we've ever made any kind of progress in terms of, you know, human rights and actual justice is sort of it seems like an accident in some ways. And I maybe I hope that's not true, but it is a way that I have of framing the world where I'm like, you know, I can't change everyone. I can just change myself. And I can just really think about the ways in which I was wounded by these narcissistic systems and how I got out. And maybe that will translate for someone else.
Well, I think it comes back to what we're doing right now and why we're doing it. We're talking about it and putting that idea out into the world, voicing it to the universe and saying, there's corruption, there's sickness. It's a sickness of society. It's a plague, like a virus. And we're naming it and calling it out and saying, hey, look, this is pervasive. It's huge. It's all around us. It's not just your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend that's a narcissist. It's not just mom or dad. It extends to all different areas in society and affects all of us profoundly. It's not just in the United States. It's global, all over the world. And it seems to be growing because narcissistic principles are encouraged. They're held in high esteem. Like, it doesn't matter how you win, just win. If you have to step up to the top on the backs of other people and harm them getting up there, hey, you got up there. Good job. Good job.
Yeah. I mean, and it's strange because when I think about the reason, you know, there were when we were evolving into be the dominant bipedal species, there were many other bipedal species around. And we won out, and scientists think we won out not because we were the most powerful, the most strong. We won out because we were taking care of our young and our old together, that we did not let our old just die, just leave them behind to die. We took care of each other in community. And it's those values for our species in particular that they think are you know, that maybe that's why we hold them ultimately as higher than these other things, these very low, you know, like whatever, you know, grabbing power and dominating people, you know. But so I like, that gives me hope.
Well, hope and concern, because it is this community that we're talking about, whether it's your work community, your school community, your church community, or just the community of citizens that live in the same city, in the same zip code as you, this sense of community is deteriorating and becoming fragmented. And technology has garnered some of the blame, like, oh, it's because everybody's on, they're so isolated. They always have their nose in their laptop or on their phone or something. Yeah. It's a contributing factor, I'm sure, but I think people,
we've been lulled in this, on this continent in particular, we have been lulled into a sense of, I think, safety and, you know, not having had any war, you know, to really threaten our sense of home and security. Mm-hmm. I feel like we are just not people who we're just anesthetized, and this spending too much time on our phones is a way of sort of hypnotizing us.
Absolutely.
Away from doing
many ways: drugs, alcohol, sex, pornography, gambling, shopping. The list goes is on and on. It's in our DNA to escape or to distract or to run away from things that are difficult or hard or unpleasant and make ourselves feel better. You got to mm-hmm. feel better. Take a prescription drug. Take a pill.
Right. I think we don't understand that all of these things are driven by trauma. The fact that we are trying to avoid, we have collective trauma and we also have individual trauma. But this, you know, we don't want to face it because it's hard. We don't know how. There's no collective conversation happening about how we face it collectively. I mean, Carl Jung tried to have that conversation over 100 years ago, and no one wanted to hear it. But he has very specific ideas about how about how fascism occurred and how to solve fascism. Nobody cares. Nobody cared. Nobody cared back then. Nobody cares now.
I ran a workshop. I'm a teacher for my day job. And I ran one on collective trauma last spring, trying to talk about how anything from like 9/11 to the pandemic and COVID and everything, you know, kids came back different. They changed. And studies have said that during the pandemic through COVID, like they have done studies on adolescent and teenage brains to show that there was a thinning of some parts of their brain, literally the physiological, like shown on a CAT scan or MRI, that their brains were altered by whatever you want to call it, by trauma, by the disconnection from other human beings and isolation from a number of factors. It changed us. And I led that thing, and you know, I didn't have that many people show up. They wanted to go to the ones that were more happy and fun. Like, let's go to a one that's like our favorite movie. Let's talk about our favorite movie, or let's do one about how to cook with more greens, or, you know, there were all kinds of choices. And I thought that was one that was like, we need to hear this. But it comes back to what you and I are doing. I think we have to open the conversation. I think we have to say it. We have to talk about it. Even when you look at people and you can see their faces glazing over, their eyes kind of just kind of get all cloudy and look away, like, and they're looking at their, like, trying to figure out an exit because they don't want to talk about it. I think these conversations have to, we just have to keep bringing them up. The flaws in the systems, the spread of narcissism, the culture that is suffering, where, you know, we have so much despair, so much PTSD and collective trauma, we don't even know what to do with, and we're just medicating and anesthetizing, like you said. I think we have to keep talking about it until people finally stop and say, you know, yeah, there is something wrong.
I think that
we need to do something about.
I mean, Carl Jung really talked about the way to solve this is through the individual. The individual has to go on their own journey. There has to be a way that we have of addressing what's in our shadow. There's a collective shadow that overwhelms us, and that's how fascism really rose up. And that we, I think you're right. I mean, to speak to this, the sort of growing societal ills.
Truth to power.
Yeah. But I think that, I know for me that there was something about Carl Jung's teachings that has always held something magical for me, in the sense that if I understand what's in my own shadow, there's tremendous power for transformation, a tremendous transformative power for me to individuate, not just from my family, not just from my trauma, but so it becomes this, it's really empowering, but it's also really magical. And it's been, for me, it's been a really tough season of healing the last year. I've been doing a lot of EMDR and a lot of internal family systems work. And a lot of dealing with a lot of Jungian analysis on my own. I was never really able to find a Jungian analyst that I worked well with. So I just really dove into his teachings on my own. And that combination for me has been life-changing. And so I don't know like how that translates for other individuals, but I do know that there's a kernel of truth in the sense that there's that everyone has to go on that journey. Everyone has to find the things that have to, first of all, acknowledge that there's trauma there, and that there's no one who's going to come and rescue them. And the way that we turn to narcissists, to other narcissists to save us, is the problem. Instead of recognizing, no, I have to save myself from this. And it's for me to deprogram myself from these narcissists is just a constant returning to, I'm fixing this. I am the one answering my own cries for help. I am doing that. And that's what I mean when I talk about internal family systems. It's talking to the protective parts. It's getting the abandoned parts to hear me, to trust me, getting the protective parts to trust me so they let go of all the like bad stuff, like the bad behaviors and the things that are the childish stuff. I mean, it's grueling work. Maybe for others.
I just think that there's a lot of people who aren't in a place right now, the majority of people, to they haven't even acknowledged the problem yet.
No, that's true.
We can get that,
but they're not. I don't think it's about speaking to the whole culture. I think it's to the people. It's about speaking to the people who are already feeling like something's wrong and they need a place to turn. And because that's where it started for me. I mean, I was a good Christian girl. I was a good conservative Republican woman. I was going to be a Christian woman and to have a Christian home and have a Christian husband and, you know, support him and all the things. And it was when I really started to understand what was wrong with that paradigm for me personally, that I began to understand what was wrong with that paradigm for everyone, because it's not a good paradigm for anyone. No. It's not an acceptable way of being. If you want to be a person who is truly, can truly be a good parent and a good mother and a good, you know, good to kids, I just don't think that paradigm is a healthy one.
No, there's so many unhealthy things all around us, more than probably the healthy. And there's a million different things on that buffet that you can sample to try to find something that's going to work for you, whether it's a Jungian archetypical shadow work or whether it's integrating all the fragmented parts of your inner self, whatever it is, there's so much to choose from. But I think that the core of the problem is people won't acknowledge that they're going to have to do self-work. They want to blame other people. They want to take a shortcut and turn to a narcissist to fix everything and just
because
that's
right
power to them.
But that's what makes, I mean, we talked about it at the very beginning. That's what makes someone vulnerable to narcissistic control and abuse is when you abdicate your own individual power to someone else to fix it, to save you.
Right. Like, I don't know how thing. Too hard, you take it. It's a learned helplessness.
And it's
here. You just take everything and handle it for me, and they'll gladly do that.
That's what they're there. That's what they're standing there waiting.
Like, yes, thank you. Yeah. And thank you again. And for your generosity, let me just, you know, got anything else in your pockets you can
pass? Let me take it all. Right.
Let me just check, you know, like check in the couch cushions, make sure you've got
everything. They know that we are ultimately, we are all afraid, right? We're all afraid of death. We're all afraid of the unknown. And that is the thing that a narcissistic, you know, someone with a cluster B personality disorder knows how to prey upon. And we can only protect ourselves when we learn that they're, first of all, we have to understand that's just we have to manage those feelings ourselves. There's no, you know, blaming another race, blaming another country, blaming someone else for those fears is a false god, right? It's not a reality. It just doesn't exist. Like, we all have those fears, and it doesn't, you know, nobody's, you know what I'm saying? Like, I guess that's it.
I think there are powers that be that want things to be polarized, divided, they promote these people with all their fake news
that's how they stay in power.
Dogs on the fire to just
but
keep
that's
it burning.
Because that's, if they don't do that, they are no longer in power. And that's what we're talking about. That is a narcissistic paradigm, right?
So
because it can only function in a narcissistic way, in a way that people are completely abdicating their individual power to this system that they just trust implicitly.
I think another thing we have to think about is that it's during difficult times when, you know, it's tough to get by. You're trying to scrape by, and you're losing your home, and you're losing your job, and you can't put food on the table, and times are scary, and you know, the future is uncertain, and it's a time of great turmoil. When people turn to things like fascism and narcissists, because it offers an extreme solution, whereas everything else has failed them and up to this point. And it seems like, oh, well, everything else had a chance and didn't work. So maybe this thing is this big grand upheaval kind of change, this dynamic thing that's going to fix everything. And if you look at the cycles and the cyclical patterns of history, that's what's happened. That's what happened in Germany with the Weimar, is that how you say it? Revolution back, you know, during that time, they were economically having a rough time when they were ripe for the picking.
That's
scary stuff. That, you know, narcissism is growing. The people that are malignant, pathological narcissists are now assuming leadership positions in all different kinds of places.
Yeah, I don't think that it's an exaggeration to say that we are on the brink of potentially a last presidency. You know, I don't think that's an exaggeration. You know,
because of what they're putting up two people that I think they're both unelectable. That's just my opinion.
Well,
I don't even want to vote. So
but you need to, because one party is driven towards fascism and the other party isn't. And that does become a lesser of two evils. But there is a very clear and distinct choice.
Was a lesser of two evils. Now it's even more than just a lesser of two evils. It's something, it's evolved into something crazy, crazy, unprecedented in history. And it comes back to, we live in a world that is lifting up the narcissist, and those are our role models, because they're the ones that are winning. Yeah, you're winning. And
it's the system is narcissistic. The system was created by narcissists for this purpose.
Yes.
And it's only was breaking down because of capitalism is breaking down. But, you know, we've become an oligarchy. So essentially, there's going to be a great amount of unrest. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that unrest is what creates a complete destabilization.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. And I want all the people listening, like the ones that need to hear this most, aren't going to be watching this. They aren't going to be listening to either one of us, probably. But I would like to think that it will come across their radar as a little blip and will give them a moment's pause to ask themselves, what's happening here? Is that true, what these people are saying? Is that really what's happening here? And to kind of start doing their own independent analysis. That's what I want to do. I'm not telling people what to think. I'm telling you need to start thinking, because these people that are disordered, that are malignant, pathological narcissists, they're going to kill you metaphorically, spiritually,
in some cases, though physically as well. I mean,
physically,
whatever serves their purposes. Yeah.
There is no other outcome. It's a death.
No, it's a zero-sum game. For them, it's a zero-sum game.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Absolutely. And now is the time to wake up. We think we have people who are woke. Oh, come on. Come on. That's you know, that is not what I'm talking about. This is a different kind of awakening to what's happening and what we need to do better. Not just for us, not what serves us, but like, for humanity, to save humanity. Maybe we don't deserve being saved, but I think we do. I would like to hope that we do, and that there's enough goodness in people and in the world so that, you know, we can just kind of wake up and shake off the stuff and put down the Cheetos and put down the beer and the remote and the video games long enough to just look around and think, what can I do to be part of the solution and not part of the problem, and not just be an escapist denying that it's even happening with my head stuck in the sand, because it's not going to fix itself.
You can only do that.
People are dangerous.
Yeah. But you can only do that if you start to really focus on your own stuff.
Yeah. And how do you get people from there to where they are?
You don't.
You got to meet people where they are.
Here's the thing. You don't, because you can't coerce. No one likes to be forced. You can't coerce anyone.
No,
that's the whole point. The point is that you provide the information for those who are looking, and it's only And then they provide the information for others. You know what I'm saying? So exactly. That's the domino effect.
So that's what we're doing. We're sounding the alarm. Ding, 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 ding. Sounding the alarm. Hey, guys, listen to this. And hopefully they will come to it on their own, because it's just like adolescence or something. You can tell them all day long. Same thing with my students. You can tell them all day long the answer. And it's like, no, 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 no. And they'll have to go find out the hard way through trial and error to discover it themselves, because they're not just going to take it as a gift from you. Like, here, take this. This is the answer. No, they're going to have to find it their way. So
right.
I hope that we can start doing that. Do you have anything you would like to leave us with? Final thoughts, contact information, anything?
Well, I mean, by contact information, do you mean like
if people wanted to recruit you to do some writing or some research or to for whatever reason?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my email address is puntonpointmedia@gmail.com. You can find my writings on Amy Punt is Sequence on Sunday on Medium, and I have a Substack, which is The Creativity to Heal. And
awesome. Yeah. I will put those links in the description below so that y'all can access those easily if you want to read some of Amy's prolific work and insights on this subject.
Okay.
Well, it's a pleasure having you here today.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for some really great conversation. And I hope I hope you listeners out there will share this with people to try to just get them thinking and getting the conversation started, and maybe start talking about solutions and what we can do to turn this thing around before we know the direction we're headed. We don't need a sign to tell us that, but thank you all for being here today.
Thanks. Bye.